welcome in. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is the All Ball Podcast, all basketball, just all sports, all the time. Welcome in. You're going to really love my guest's journey. His name is Phil Hickey. He starred 4 years at Notre Dame. He's got an unbelievable personal story of overcoming adversity while in college, and now he's out in the world as a marketer. And if you love the Angry Birds franchise, you'll love what he's done as he's all grown up from his days as a wee youngster in Wellsboro, Pennsylvania. I want to give you a little bit of hoop stuff in terms of up-to-date hoop stuff before we get to my guest, Phil Hickey. The first thing is the upcoming NBA draft. It is, in fact, a total crapshoot, right? And having talked to some of these GMs, it's kind of fascinating to me on how many are like, you know, I don't necessarily know if I have enough data. It's like one of the things that we get from the NCAA tournament that so many people undervalue is the ability to see these guys play at a higher level of intensity, often against other players, as opposed to, you know, kind of the regular season game where you're seeing some of these one and done kids barely play. I guess it helps, you know, the couple of players that went and played overseas, but even that was a long time ago. And I mean, think about it. It's been since what, like early February, right? Since we've gotten a chance to see Melo Ball play when he was in Israel. In Australia. The interesting thing about Melo Ball, and there's a lot of chatter about him. He's long. He can really pass. Shooting's not good. And I think, look, some of the things that his brother has accomplished, although he has not lived up to the number two overall draft pick, I think helps him. He's bigger than his brother. He's probably a better game passer than his brother. He better play pick and roll than his brother. Never played pick and roll before he got in the NBA. And his brother has made himself into a tremendous athlete and into a tremendous defender. And so the thought is that though Melo doesn't play any defense right now, when he gets to the league, well, he probably will. I guess. The shooting gives me pause because while the brother Lonzo has improved athletically, the shooting just hasn't gotten better. And if you look at when he played in Australia, he didn't shoot the basketball well, you know, mid-20s from three, mid-30s from the field. And this is a guy that shoots kind of breakaway layups, granted playing against men. But and there are many that believe, well, listen, if you improve the shot selection, you got the space of an NBA court. I don't know. There's pretty good spacing when you play in Israel, when you play in Australia. I'm surprised if people want to convince themselves of that. I'd be very, very cautious if a kid isn't competitive defensively at all, making him the number one overall pick. And I think the Warriors pick is very much up in the air. I know that guys like Isaac Okoro, who has a great kind of culture, passion to the guy. It's going to take a special fit to the Warriors because they want to win and win now. Don't be surprised if to get an asset, they trade down or they take a guy who they think fits their culture, maybe better than how highly rated a player is. There's thoughts that James Wiseman, because they need size and need length and they need versatility, maybe, but I'm not sold and neither are they that he can help them play right away. So whoever they're picking, they're not expecting to help them play for 2 years, maybe even 3 years. Granted, what's interesting is there'll be no summer league, but there could be very little ramp up, right? You get drafted in November, you could play in December. I'm not sure you're going to get much out of this rookie class if you're a playoff team at all. So that needs to be factored in, especially if you're a team like the Warriors who have great expectations of themselves coming off a year in which they kind of packed it in for a year. As for the NBA coming back early, I think they have to. They have to find a way to get this thing wrapped up to where they have the finals back on time. One, they want to be at the Olympics with maybe not all of their stars, but a better allotment of stars, whereas the initial plan was to forget about the Olympics. They need that for the business side. They also need to be playing on Christmas Day for the business side. Granted, they need to get people in the stands, and that's something that's completely out of their control at this particular moment. But I do believe that the NBA needs to and will get on the floor in December. All right, let's get to my conversation with Phil Hickey. One of the things that comes up is mental health, and it's really interesting how different we assess somebody's shooting difficulties, somebody's personal mental health. In this case, Phil had a fear of flying. Obviously, I've had my own kind of personal issues with depression. I've heard Mark Titus talk about that extensively in his book, in podcast as well. I mean, these are things that when I was playing in college basketball 20 years ago, nobody discussed, right? You had the yips or you were scared of something and you got over it. And we worked with you on it. I think you'll love this conversation. Phil Hickey, by my estimation, outstanding player. Okay. Gigantic body, huge hips, big, soft hands. I think had we had a little bit more evolved training program at Notre Dame, I think he would have been a little more twitchy. And had we played a little bit different style, like this dude was a center who could score in the low post. He also had great hands so he could catch and finish. It took him a while to develop any sort of explosiveness. Some of that is because the toe injury that he suffered before he got to college. But take a listen to my conversation with my man, Phil Hickey, graduate 1999 of the University of Notre Dame. All right, let's welcome him in. He's the pride of Wellsboro, Pennsylvania. He's the one and only Phil Hickey. Phil, how are you?
I'm good, Doug. How are you doing?
Good. Okay, so I think we should go back to our early days at Notre Dame, right? Where sure. You were this giant teddy bear of a guy who everybody loved, not because you're a nice guy, but because your dorm room at Dillon Hall was the home of 40s at four, right? Like I don't know if it was an NCAA violation. And I believe we've passed the statute limitations, but what do you recall about how you became the hub for all the drinking of 40s at 4 o'clock on a Friday at Notre Dame?
I have no idea, but I think it wasn't performance enhancing either. I think we probably had one extra square foot than all the other dorm rooms. Cause I think they were about 10 square feet a piece and we had one that was 11 or 12 square feet. So in college terms, that means you can fit about four more people in that room.
Unless of course they're with you because you're a bigger dude. And so yeah, you needed the extra space. I think now that we're older, it's like, man, one, I do wish that they let us room together when we were freshmen. And I also wish that I was able to articulate things like, what was it like for you? Like you first, you're from a small town. You show up at a place like Notre Dame. What do you recall was like for you when you first got there?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The rooming rules have certainly changed over the years, but showing up, it was pretty amazing, right? It's this beautiful campus. It's out of everywhere I was looking, it was the farthest one away from my home. You know, grew up with a single mom. There were those kind of difficulties, you know, I guess growing up always dreaming of going somewhere big and getting out of the town and, you know, to the big city. This wasn't quite the big city, but it was definitely a big media capital. It was just kind of raised a lot of questions. Can I make it here? You know, and I think, you know, it drives down to the very first day being at Notre Dame. And I remember stopping up at the office and, the only coach that was there was Coach Terry Tyler. And, he was what, 3 years out of the league maybe at that point. Yeah. And, you know, I had never shot around in the Joy Center. He's like, oh, let's go shoot a couple shots, which is probably a violation at this point, but, who knows with NCAA rules. But I remember just shooting a couple shots, going to the foul line, you know, taking a look at the place, kind of thinking this is going to be my home for the next 4 years. And I remember maybe the third or fourth foul shot, I shot it. And Terry was in a nice, you know, Notre Dame polo shirt, some tucked in khaki pants, you know, his dress shoes. And it hit the front of the rim, bounced straight up. He goes off of 2 feet. And just dunks it. And my reaction was like, holy shit, if this is what our coaches can do, I mean, what's NCAA Division I going to be like?
Here's what I remember about Coach Tyler. Okay, I have a couple of recollections of him. Okay. One was Thanksgiving at his house.
Amazing. Right?
And he had like a condo and he was newly married. And I remember all the freshmen, that's where we went over. And the food was amazing. But it was more like, that's like one of my top five memories of all my college experiences, right? Is that like, we were kind of all together, right? We had Gary Bell, who was this super loud, arrogant dude from Chicago, right? You had Antoni Weiss, who's like the nicest guy ever from, upstate New York, you from tiny Wellsboro, Pennsylvania, me from Southern California. And like this, the brotherhood of all kind of being together. I remember eating and then we were like watching football and everybody like fell dead out of sleep. And then somebody woke somebody up and like, hey, we got another practice. but it was just, it was so cool. And right. Like you had a mixture of cultures. It was like my first, like, look, when you grow up in Southern California and you play basketball and you travel around the country, like my teams were always either half or mostly black anyway.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like I wasn't around black people, but to mix those kind of cultures to me, I don't know, that was like a special memory to me. I was like, man, this is super cool to be. Nobody liked practicing, especially the second time, but it was just the idea of being around Coach Tyler. He was so cool. And the mixing of the cultures and finding out that people eat different stuff for the same holiday.
For sure. I mean, I remember that I think that's the first time I ever had some soul food. I mean, there was amazing collard greens, a few other things that were amazing. And yeah, that was a great memory. It also felt like a refuge from, you know, being a freshman, going through two-a-days and all that kind of stuff. And it just felt like a little vortex into a place where we could relax a bit and kind of be ourselves. And
you went through like the opposite of what me and Tony Weiss went through. Like I gained, I think 17 pounds from when I got there to our first game. Anthony Weiss had never lifted before. So he like couldn't shoot for like, remember he couldn't like even hit the rim on a,
he was about 5 feet off on a 10 foot shot.
Yeah. Yeah. You were trying to trim up your body. Like that's hard in college. What was that like?
Man, that was hard. I mean, that all, you know, that started the summer of my, you know, really the spring and summer of my senior year, kind of getting on that process and just learning to eat differently, to kind of work my body a bit harder, to really concentrate on things, you know, a lot more running than I was used to. I mean, I there were a couple extra things that helped me at Notre Dame was I failed the swim test, if you remember that.
I remember that, yeah.
I couldn't do a backstroke. So I was doing extra swimming laps at eight in the morning before every class. So that helped. And you know, the level of conditioning, but it's a hard change. I mean, it worked. I mean, they have some, you know, I was the only one not taking whey. Everyone else was, remember those were the whey days where everyone was taking whey and then drinking these
Gator creatine load. As well. Creatine, Gator load and whey.
Right? Yeah. That was the breakfast of champions back then. So I was focusing on that. I don't know if you remember, but I also, before my senior year, I had that lawnmower accident, which was just insane. Kind of mowing the lawn outside and it was a wet day, slipped a little bit and the blade hit my big toe and shattered it into what the doctor said, you know, looked like Rice Krispies. So that had to be fused. So I have just one bone in my right toe. So that also helped. I had to change my diet because I couldn't exercise for,
I had no idea.
Oh yeah. That was insane. So that was an unlucky moment. I mean, it was scary actually, because, you know, calling up Coach McLeod and the team and saying, I don't know what this means. The first doctor.
Phil,
I looked at.
Okay, Phil, we gotta get to the doctor. Go check that out. Check out them toes.
Exactly. And the first doctor told me I'd never play basketball again. So it was, you know, and then we went down to a bigger city. I think we went to the Penn State Orthopedics and they're like, hey, we can fix this. It's just going to take some work. So,
yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, what you should have got was like, listen, he can't do conditioning. You can't do like court conditioning. You can't run to water the way exactly. That John McClay's dad run to water. I tweeted about this the other day. I remember Coach McLeod having to wear jock straps, right? Or we were supposed to wear jock straps. Can't forget. Okay. So let me kind of set the table. So John McLeod had us, among the things we had to do, we had to get taped every day and he would actually feel inside your sock sometimes to make sure you were taped. We had to wear suits and ties on the road and we were supposed to wear jock straps. And, you know, after a while, I was like, no, I don't want this fucking jock strap. It's terrible. And we used to get hype for practice. Sometimes we do like two line layups and everybody go ahead, throw it down, big fella. All right, Phil, here we go. Here we go. Here we go, Notre Dame. Right. And so, you know, you're going in layup lines and Gary Bellstraight had a back surgery. He's like doing 360s. Like, didn't you just hurt your back? Anyway, calls us in and starts checking randomly jock straps. And I believe you got caught. Is that accurate that you didn't have a jock on?
I got caught. Somehow he had heard someone narked on me or there was a recording device in the locker, our tiny, tiny locker room, one or the other. But not only did he catch, but he checked three or four times. He checked every part of my body to see if I was hiding it or if I was. And remember, his moves were super deliberate and they were very like kind of hard, but like, you know, it was just, it was one of the most awkward moments of my life. But I wore jock straps after that. I didn't want that again. It was, I mean, it was the TSA's. I mean,
you tell people this now and like, look, we didn't go to school in the 1970s, right? You finished in 1999, right?
Like exactly.
And they're like, you wait, what? Yes,
that jockstrap still exists. I mean, do kids even know what a jockstrap is anymore?
No, I was telling my son the story, and he's like, "What are they?" Because that was when. I don't think so. I don't know.
Maybe baseball. A catcher might still wear something like that. Maybe.
So the most remarkable thing about you, and I want to get to what you're doing now, is that during our freshman year, early on. And I think the first time I noticed was when we flew to Cincinnati. We played Xavier in the old Cincinnati Gardens.
Yeah.
And you were really, really uncomfortable flying. Yep. And, you know, like 19-year-old Doug Gottlieb is like, check out Phil. He's sweating his ass off, right?
Yeah.
40-year-old Doug Gottlieb is like, yeah, that's actually like a phobia, like legit fear, phobia, obviously knowing what you went through. So, we go to Villanova on January 2nd. They're ranked second in the country.
Yep.
And I remember a lot of things about that game, mostly that we're gonna leave Alvin Williams. I was guarding Alvin Williams. you had to guard either Chuck Cornegay or Jason Lawson, right? Jason, they had two-headed monsters.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? They had Eric Ebers, the great shooters, like 6'5", and they had Kerry Kittles. And they're like, all right, their weak link shooting-wise is Alvin Williams. So, Doug, every time they get the ball down low, you go double. Every time one of their guards puts the ball on the floor, you go, help, let's leave Alvin Williams. And first four possessions, it felt like, is whap, 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 whap. And he hits three threes and has an open two. And he's got 11 points at the first TV timeout. And I go over to Fran McCaffrey, recruited us both. And I was like, Fran, we going to let him get 80 tonight, or are we going to like guard him, right? So we got our ass kicked on ESPN2 on January 2nd. And we're in Philadelphia.
Yep.
And we go to the airport. Okay. You want me to tell my recollection of it or yours?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. Ahead. So my recollection is we're all in our coats and ties, parkas over the top. And Pat Garrity, who was a sophomore, was like our leader, was just the greatest, smartest, nicest guy. He comes over and he's like, bro, you got to get your boy in the plane. And I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, Phil said he's not getting on the plane. I was like, what? So we go and we're talking to you and you're clearly uncomfortable and you're very shy at times. At the time you're looking down, you're like, oh, I'm not getting that plane. I'm like, come on, dude, we gotta go home. Like, we got a game in like 3 days. Like I'm not getting on the plane. So then Hoove comes over and he's like, hey boy, come on. Man. Like, we gotta, like the plane hadn't yet opened up the doors. So I walk over to Fran McCaffrey and I was like, Franny, Phil says he's not getting on the plane, and I believe him. And he's like, you know, Fran comes over, and he's like, yo, Phil, what's up, man? What's up? You know, he saw SportsCenter last night. Gottlieb got turned around. Like, all right, hey, man, I got to get on that plane. I get on that plane. So somehow word filters down, again, to John McLeod. And, like, I want to make sure that people who watch this and listen to this, I don't think he had a mean, bad bone in his body. There was just a certain, like, not necessarily rigid, but I don't know if he understood all the things going on for you. Like, I don't necessarily know all the things that were going on with you. Like you said, single mom, small town, toe, losing weight, fighting for minutes. Practices were like brutally, brutally physical. It's hard to get minutes. We weren't very good. Like, all of these things kind of culminating at once, right? Yeah. It's your mind's kind of spinning. You got grades. Like, I was doing shitty in school. And, you know, like, his whole thing is he comes up to you and he's like, all right, there, big fellow. Okay. Hey, Philly, how we doing today? How we doing? All right, we're going to get on that plane. And you just like looked at him, like you looked up, like, coach, I'm not getting on that plane. All right, Phil, listen, we got to get back on that plane. We're like, coach, I'm not getting on that plane. He's like, you can all go. You got to get home. I'm not flying. And then somebody scrambled and like called your mom, and she turned around and drove from like Wellsboro and picked you up. It was like a 4-hour drive or something crazy, right? So, okay, you go.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's basically how it happened. I mean, I think, you know, looking back at it, you know, it's a combination of a lot of things, right? I mean, I think I, looking back with a clear conscience and the kind of lens of, you know, mental health awareness, I think that the broken toe started giving me a bit of anxiety, if I think about it, because I mean, you know, when you're a senior in high school, you're going to D1, you feel like you're indestructible and nothing can stop right. you. And all of a sudden out of nowhere, this bad thing happens. Right. And then the combination of, I mean, losing to this day still makes me sick. Like it makes me physically sick. I'm a bear. I can't talk to anyone. I feel terrible. I'm disappointed in myself. And we were taking L's left, right, and center. I mean, that Big East was full of Allen Iversons, Kerry Kittles. I mean, I think that, you know, Boston College was amazing. Ray Allen's at Connecticut, right? I mean, and we're trying to play man. You know, the thing you mentioned about the Alvin story is like we played man to man. We didn't play any zone, so we were. I mean,
two games. We played zone.
Yeah,
Georgetown both times, right?
Yeah, Georgetown. Yeah. exactly. But yeah. So it's a mixture of that stuff, and then we talked about Cincinnati. I remember we beat Xavier. I think I had some foul shots at the end or near the end.
You did. You stepped up, you nutted up and hit two big free throws.
Yeah. And then we flew back after that for Christmas, and I had a super bumpy flight, as bumpy as it could be, kind of where the wings are going left, right. And, you know, I remember having some books that flew out into the middle, and I was burnt. I got off that plane and, you know, put on a smiley face, but I was burnt between all of that and that last flight. And it just carried over. And I just kept thinking about that, you know, the whole Christmas break. And, you know, when you build something up into your head, it's very hard to kind of break it down. And, you know, there were, to be honest, back then, there weren't a lot of resources for things like that. There weren't help. I mean, I, in the end we can get to that, but that, I mean, that was basically your story spot on. And coach, you know, I think coach handled it pretty gracefully. My mom came, we figured it out over Christmas break. I came back, worked on it, figured it out. And
people are such assholes though. Like I remember that they drove you to the Georgetown game.
Yeah. Correct.
And we come out to warm up and they're throwing paper airplanes at you. And I was just like, you guys are at like, cause, and again, part of it is we were friends and like, you're one of the nicest, sweetest, most genuine people I've ever met. And so like it hurt me and I'm like, hey, assholes, do you know how hard it is for the guy even to get like, he's so embarrassed by this. And there's nothing. It's just, he's just afraid to fly. Like it had like John Madden wouldn't fly. Right.
Yeah.
And, yeah. But you did ultimately, even in that year, overcome it. Right.
I did. Yeah. Yeah.
Like you've lived overseas. Like it's not just, you didn't just overcome it. It wasn't like just I'll take one flight or I'll just do it for basketball. Like you lived, worked, and I think met your wife overseas, right?
Correct. So yeah, it was important. It was an important turning point in my life. And it's like, you know, and Coach McLeod was right. Like there's sometimes to get where you want to go, there's things you got to overcome. And you know, it was for me, it was more of an analytical thing. We broke it down. The mental health aspect of things weren't, it wasn't cool to have mental health issues back then. You know, it just, everyone was, especially men were the silent kind of hold it in type. And, you know, now everybody's got seeing a psychologist or a consultant or something like that, life coach. But yeah, I got over it. I remember we went in, you know, Skip and I went to the South Bend airport. We met with the pilots. They explained everything of how flight works, all the science behind it, all the physics behind it. And it was pretty enlightening. And while there were assholes that were giving me a hard time, I was receiving crazy amounts of fan mail, both to my own house and stuff of people saying like pretty inspirational stuff. I had the same problem. This is how I overcame it. Hang in there. You'll get it. And, you know, I received, you know, it felt like I was being recruited again. I got like 2,000 letters or something nuts, books on it, you know, people saying, give me a call sometime. I'll tell you how I dealt with it. So, I mean, there was a good part of humanity and that was super helpful. And I remember my first flight back, it wasn't a terrible one. We took the Pistons team plane to somewhere.
That's right. Yes.
And then I was like, hey, this isn't actually that bad. You know,
We took it to New York. We flew into Teterboro.
And
they would tell you like, all right, Phil, we're banking to the right.
That was helpful, though. It was to be honest,
really helpful,
right? Yeah.
You know, here's what's fascinating, okay? And I don't know if you know this, but if you go back before in the preseason, Admore White, the other point guard, was kicking my ass. And I only went to Notre Dame because I thought it was going to be awesome. I liked everybody. I thought I was going to the NBA. I thought I was going to start for 4 years, right? And this guy's just killing me every day in practice. And like everything we did emphasized what I didn't do well. Like I was good in the full court. We played all half court basketball. Like in practice, it was half court basketball, 26 seconds in the shot clock. Yeah. I'd never run a motion offense in my life. I'd never done, and I'm just getting screened and screened and screened, right? And Admore White had this really good mid-range jump shot. Like I had no mid-range jump shot, right? Every ball screen we ran was to somebody's right hand. I could only shoot going to my left hand, like literally everything. So I went into Fran McCaffrey's office and I just started bawling like a baby. Like you talk about mental health. Like I was seriously clinically depressed. The sun hadn't come out in a month. I tracked it in my room in October. The sun did not come out. October, November didn't come out one time. Not one time did I see the sun. Yeah. And like, I didn't feel right. I felt off. I start bawling like a baby again. Like now you'd go see a shrink. Instead, it was Fran calling me every night, checking in on me. How you doing? You okay? Like I'm all right. You know, I kind of want to go home, you know? Yeah. He's like, well, you can't go home. You got to go to practice tomorrow. Like, okay, you know, that's what I'll do. And, you know, I had obviously my own issues manifest themselves, I think, like kind of later on that year. But it's interesting on how, like, we were still not really evolved. And it was a very, everything about it was a little arcane when you look at it now through the lens of 2020.
For sure. For sure. And I remember Fran always telling me, like, hey, make sure you stop by Doug's room and make sure he's coming. Practice. See if he's left.
I used to do this thing where my room faced the south quad, and I would open up the window. I'd stick my hand out, like not going to class today. Too cold. No, not doing that. And then you'd come walking by with your big parka on, and you're like, all right, let's go. Okay, so how would you characterize your career at Notre Dame?
Solid. Solid, right? You know, I think it was interesting. You know, did we get enough wins that I would like? No. I mean, you know, that was, we're NIT contenders. We played with some good people. I mean, I think, you know, I ended up near 1,000 points and, you know, however many rebounds and, you know, block shots and things like that, you know, and it was a great experience. I'm glad I wouldn't change it for anything. You know, I would have definitely tried to plead our case to play a little bit more zone. I think that could have made the difference of 3 or 4 wins a year. We were you know, outmatched athletically. And, you know, it reminds me of a good story on that is playing in the Big East tournament 1 year. I got a terrible foul call on me and turned to the ref and be like, what was that? He's like, I either had to call that on you or Garrity. Who do you think should take the foul? It's like, all right. Because we knew if Pat gets 4 fouls, he's coming out. We're not going to zone. You know what I mean? But I loved it. I loved the campus. You know, there was a ton of turnover. I think we were kind of that, you know, Antoni and I sticking out 4 years of our class, you know, kind of the glue that kind of allowed more people to came. We started to get, you know, the Troy Murphys and the Matt Carrolls and stuff after that. So it was a transition from what the early 90s were to what Mike Bray's built now, but enjoyed it. Gave me a ton of opportunities. Got to play overseas for a lot of years. So, no regrets.
I'll just say this. I apologize to you. And I've done this to Fran. I did to Coach McLeod before he passed. This is the arrogant me, right? Because David Lalazarian came in. He's my high school teammate. He's one of my best friends. He comes in the next year. If I don't get in trouble, I don't leave. David stays. And there's no disrespect to Jimmy Dillon who replaced me, or Martin Inglesby, who ended up ultimately coming in and being the point guard.
Yep.
But I think we make the NCAA tournament. I think we accomplish all of our goals, and I didn't want to leave. Our first year didn't go well. And I was thinking about this place for me anyway, but I was going to come back and stick it out. And I think ultimately, you know, that second, third year, it always ends up being better.
Yeah.
But I apologize to you because I screwed it up for everybody.
No worries. Shit happens, man. You know, I support you and have some talks for people who don't support you. I think it's ridiculous. People are stupid, but you know, you're a 19-year-old kid from California. I don't even know how you're coming from having sushi to most people never even hearing sushi at that point in Notre Dame. You know, you're coming from warm weather to maybe the shittiest weather in America. You know, it's yeah, it's difficult. And it's difficult.
There's certain things I dug about it. I mean, there's some, and like, I truly believed year two, year three, year four, like I would have just loved it. There's just culturally, like I'd never been to a private school. I didn't know anything about the religion. You know, school was really, really hard. Like you think you're smart because you can get into Notre Dame and you're like, oh my God, everybody here is a genius.
It really was.
Everybody here's.
And the expectations. I remember being at the Big East tournament and having to overnight mail my final from New York because there were zero exceptions on the academic front, you know?
Which like now, like I actually respect and like about the school. Like even the fact that they could have, like I begged and pleaded to a couple of the kids who I stole from and they could have, you know, let it go, but they were just like, that's just not who we are. Which I like again, 20 years later, I would totally respect. But at the time I was like, man, that's not right. Right. That's not fair. And you know, I do think that for the most part, I know that there's some hypocrisy to Catholicism and values and Christianity and et cetera. But as far as that's concerned, I actually really admire that about the school.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, those experiences make you who you are today. Right. And the flying incident, this incident, it's made you who you are and you've overcome and you've probably become more successful than you would have been if that hadn't happened, you know?
Probably. So you get done playing and what happens?
Then, yeah.
Get done playing at Notre Dame. At Notre Dame. Get done playing at Notre Dame.
Coach calls me like immediately after the season, tells me he's going to, you know, be replaced. Matt Doherty comes in. So I'm also lost with that because I'm not sure like what's going on with this team. Like the team's in a bit of limbo. There's no trainings. You know, I'm kind of practicing for Portsmouth, you know, dreaming of still playing, carrying on, and you know, go to Portsmouth. Didn't go amazingly well. We didn't have a really good team. And you know, was thinking, okay, well, what what's next? And you know, I think I got invited to the free agent camp for the Pacers that summer. Walk in, you know, talk about a small kid from Wellsboro, walk in and most people have their assistant coaches. Larry Bird's coaching it. Rick Carlisle's assistant. You know, you have people fighting for contracts like Austin Crozier. That's, you know, a third year veteran still playing the free agent camp, comes in unbelievably in shape, just killing people. You had Al Harrington. You had Jeff Foster, who played many years for them.
Sure.
You basically had the whole roster except for the starting five. So, I mean, it was an amazing experience. There was no room for me. Not that I would have made it anyway if I was different, but great learning experience. And I also realized, like, my God, all right, here's what the next level's like. So, you know, went and worked out. Ended up signing in this. I went over to France for a month, pre-internet days, you know, calling mom was, you know, $10 in a payphone a minute. And I was there for about 6 weeks and they gave me $100 as for my meals. And I was like, all right, this isn't working. Get me out of here. They're like, oh, we don't have.
Where in France?
A town called Beauvais, a little bit north of, it was a Pro B. So they were good. And I just called my agent. I'm like, I got to get out of here. A guy named Dave Maravella, who was a great agent. Now he's running Don Bosco kind of prep stuff in Northwestern Indiana now. And we go there, I come back. I'm like, all right, well, that didn't work. And that was a terrible experience. And it actually cost me money to be there, you know, and when you have no money to begin with out of college. So I'm like, this somehow the economics of basketball is not working. And then I get, so it's late in the year and think about going overseas again. And then I get a call to come try out for a new league called the IBL, which was kind of taking the mantle of the CBA. And went and played for a team called the Cincinnati Stuff, coached by Joby Wright. And, you know, we had Scott Spinelli was his assistant coach, Greg Herenda, a bunch of guys. And we put a team together there and we had a great team. We had, you know, I think your boy, Tremaine Folks. We had, you know, Lenny Brown from Xavier. We had Melvin Levitt and Damon Flint from Cincinnati, Wayne Turner from Kentucky, Sumaila Samaki. Do you remember that guy? Played for the Lakers.
Sure.
A while. Chris Kingsbury, an Iowa legend from Cincinnati. We had a good team and, but you know, I hated it. It was, everyone was trying to get a 10-day contract. You know, it was, we won. I think we were 41-20 or something. We had the best record in the league, but it just wasn't fun. It wasn't what I thought basketball would be. So I made it through that year, decided what's next, and then got a call to go play in Finland on 7 days notice. Like, hey, pack your bags. You got this thing. You got to leave now. And when did that, and then ended up playing in Europe and really love the experience and love the basketball is more my style in Europe, to be honest.
No, well, I think, well, you look, your experience in the minor leagues is anybody who I believe, like, I don't know, who loves how you're supposed to play basketball is the same as mine, right? Like just, and I tell people this all the time, like, well, you know, if you don't make the league, you go to the G League. Like, you do understand that minor league basketball is the worst, like literally the worst. Forget about the money and the place you play. It's just like, it's when you come from college where all you're doing is playing for each other and for your school. And now the only thing you're playing for is for, to get somewhere else.
Yeah.
It goes counter to everything, you know, and everything you should play for. Right. Exactly. Like that's kind of the, so that's the thing. Like I remember being, I was in the ABA, I was in that IBL with the Salina Rattlers.
Oh yeah. Yep. Yep.
Before I went to Russia, that was the following year from you. But I remember being the ABA and we had this unbelievable team and Jamel Thomas, and we had all these, and we're playing against all these Derek Martin and Sed Sabalos and all these guys that just, all they want to do is get back to the NBA. And it was like, they were simply playing so that the box score would look good. If you sent clips of them, you know, shooting and scoring, it would look good. Nothing really mattered. The final score did not matter. Where to me, like the score was all that mattered. Like that's it.
And, totally agree. You know, totally agree.
Yeah.
It's just
okay.
Not-
so, So Finland.
Yeah.
You land in Finland. What city do you live in, Landon?
I lived in Helsinki. So actually where the airport is. So there's a greater area, Helsinki, Vantaa, Espoo. And I was playing in the team in Vantaa. Near the airport. Interesting country. It's already winter when I arrived in August, pretty much. Days where, I mean, if we thought South Bend was bad weather, Helsinki says, hold my beer. You know, very quiet people. Didn't know much about it. Knew a little bit about Sweden. We had an exchange student from Sweden, so a little knew about the Nordics. You know, I remember going to the first day of workouts and Hanno Metala was working out with the team. You know, obviously he had great career at Utah, and I don't know if he was playing with the Hawks that year, if he was playing in one of the bigger European countries, but his best friend was on our team. And so there was that familiarity and, you know, talking to them and kind of learning it, but it was massively different. And I learned a lot that first month on just how to play, how to, you know, first time I'd ever seen the Euro step. I just, contemplating that in the night, like, how do I do that? Is that a travel? Is it not a travel? How do they get away with it? You know, just, you know, a lot of plyometrics. The first time, you know, if you remember, Coach McLeod never would allow us to do squats or cleans or any of those things. And the first time I'd done those in my life, and it actually helped quite a bit. You know, I think we learned to do that right. But yeah, crazy language, crazy time. Basketball was kind of like a low D1, you know, kind of high D2 level, but with men, you know, and create, you know, no flying, all bus rides to the middle of nowhere. But yeah, it was absolutely crazy. And, you know, if we were homesick going to college, the first week there was, you know, incredibly homesick, but it got over it, learned a lot and kind of went on to play other places in Europe after that.
Did you develop Angry Birds?
I didn't myself. So that is a Finnish company. Yeah, I'll fill you in quick on the rest of Europe. So after, you'll enjoy this one. After there, I went to London. We were the worst team ever in the history of the EuroLeague, 0-16.
Which team?
The London Towers. So we're in a group. We're in a group with Barcelona. We were in a group with Kinder Bologna that had Marco Jaric, Ginobili, Rashard Griffith, David Anderson. But I mean, the teams were stacked. But that was a big boon by the guy who ran that. I think he just took the sponsor money and barely paid anything for us. So that was interesting. Then I went to Slovenia. Love that. Great basketball. Former Yugoslavia basketball fit me really well. And then kind of got hurt my knee and went back to Finland. And that's where I did. I was on scholarship again. They offered me a contract to do my MBA for 2 years and play for that team. And did that. Got a job at Nokia, you know, mobile phones.
Okay, so you get a job at Nokia. What year is this?
This is 2005, 2006, maybe.
Okay. So this is after, like, my first cell phone was 2000. It was a Nokia. Yeah. Everybody had those Nokia little phones.
The 3210.
The company was the company was hot as can be. What was your first job there?
Yeah. My first job was a inbox marketing manager. So just making sure that people that open the box had a good experience, from the CD-ROMs to the pamphlets, what the box looked like, all that kind of stuff. And then kind of moved into events, launched the first 1 megapixel mobile phone, and kind of went to the first smartphones. And then worked on a little bit of N-Gage, which was the first gaming system on mobile phones.
So pretty awesome.
Yeah, it was way ahead of its time. Way ahead of its time.
I have so many questions.
Go ahead.
Why BlackBerry die?
BlackBerry died because it just didn't advance, right? I mean, it was just an email solution on a device, and everyone else figured out how to make that same email solution, especially as touch screens got bigger and you had enough room for your fingers. So I heard they still exist. They're bought by the Chinese and they still run some kind of things in India.
Okay. So then what do you do now?
So what I do now, I basically, after that, there was a little company, Rovio and Angry Birds, right? You know, three doors down from us, played the game, got super addicted on a flight to London. Like, this is incredible. Reached out to them, did some work with them at Nokia, and they were pretty small at that point. And they said, hey, when we grow a little bit and we have enough money for some marketing, we'll look at you. Went in, you know, met the team and worked there for 4 years, kind of headed up Angry Birds Space and Angry Birds Star Wars, you know, working with Lucasfilm and spending some time out there and working with NASA, hanging out at the, you know, I mean, NASA was totally crazy. The, you know, head administrator of NASA wanted, you know, education, science to be cool and fun and make a comeback. And yeah, they were just absolutely amazing experiences.
Have you ever had that moment where you're like, okay, I went to Notre Dame from Wellsboro, Pennsylvania, and I was overwhelmed then. Now I'm at NASA and Lucasfilms.
Yeah, yeah. And
jet setting from Finland to London to LA to Houston to wherever. Have you ever had that moment?
Definitely had that moment multiple times. You know, sometimes you got to pinch yourself, and it was a lot of fun, and we're doing really interesting things and learned everything from Rovio. And then two of my colleagues started a company called CRC Digital Entertainment, and we have a game called Best Fiends. And we basically thought we could, you know, learn what we did from, you know, because Angry Birds wasn't just a game. It was a brand. It was a lifestyle. And it was the first
movie.
Yeah. And it came from your pocket. Right. And so we thought we could, you know, we could build Hollywood's, and that didn't come deliberately. They just made some good decisions along the way, but we thought there was an opportunity to build that out of from scratch and think about how to build an IP on a phone that could become a movie, could become shorts, could become products, could become a game. And Best Fiends did that, and we've built it up. It's kind of it's currently now a kind of iPhone classic game. It's a puzzle game, you know, Candy Crush meets Pokemon maybe. And we were purchased by an Israeli company last year called Playtika, and it's been wonderful. They've been great. It's a long way from Wellsboro, PA, to say the least.
Best food in Finland is what?
Best food in Finland is called salmon soup. And so everything there is hearty. Number two would be reindeer and lingonberries over mashed potatoes. But salmon soup.
Wait. Really reindeer? Like true reindeer?
True reindeer, Rudolph. They always joke about it. So they cook Rudolph many ways. There's a blue cheese and reindeer pizza that you can have. But the traditional way is kind of slow cooked over, you know, in a gravy, in a saute for 24 hours, and then cook, set over mashed potatoes.
What's the next big game?
The next big game. That's a good question. I mean, everything is moving to P versus P and being able to talk and communicate and have a social group through that. So it's hard to tell. It's hard to tell the next new game, because everyone's being the winners are becoming bigger and the losers are becoming, you know, bigger losers, to be honest. And it's kind of like what's going on in tech right now. So I don't know. I think people aren't investing so much in new games as they are kind of adding content and experiences to current games.
Pretty amazing. Pretty cool though, right? Like all the things you've done, all the places you've been, and here you are getting a chance to do all the stuff with games. Like, you know, right? Like, pretty amazing life.
Oh, it's funny when your parents told you stop playing video games, stop playing that Nintendo. You'll never be able to do that when you're older. You got to study. And then here I am. That's what I do all day. Can't complain.
Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing stuff. Let's get together and break bread outside of this. I appreciate your time. I love your journey, and we got to do that soon.
Yeah, I would love that. All right. Thanks, Doug. Great catching up.
Thank you, Phil.
All right. Speak soon.
Wow. It was great, right? I mean, he's just, an interesting and fascinating guy who now, anytime you download a video game, you'll be thinking, I wonder if Phil Hickey is marketing this thing. I will. Just one thought on college basketball, which I find to be interesting. By the way, you can catch the Doug Gottlieb Show daily, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific, on your iHeartRadio app or on your Fox Sports radio station. The Orlando pod is out, right? The Orlando bubble is out. There's a lot of different things. One, there's the concerns about COVID. There's the testing and the protocols and different states and schools coming from different states and different sorts of travel. And there's all kinds of restrictions. There's also, it's really expensive. Like, bubbles are really expensive. And though these tournaments are willing to cover a good amount of the costs, and ESPN and Fox and CBS Sports trying to cover some of the costs, the fact is that there is no revenue right now for college sports, college basketball. You're simply, you know, handing out money to have players on campus, to have all of these protocols in place. Without the non-conference games, remember, those are where the small programs make the money and the big programs fill up their gym and also make additional revenues for the radio rights, for parking, for season tickets, et cetera, et cetera. Like, those are big money makers anytime they open the gates. And without those, boy, I wonder what happens to low major basketball. I wonder what happens to mid-major basketball. And I wonder what happens to high major basketball. And as much as we think we're less than a month away from the season tipping off, like, Cal can't practice for 2 weeks. How are they going to play in 4 weeks? How's that going to happen? Other programs are without any question going to have to take a break. I mean, if football programs are missing football games and having to shut down football practices, when you got 15 kids in a basketball program, somebody's going to get sick and they're going to have to shut things. My guess is, and look, this is why it was smart for college basketball to say we'll start during Thanksgiving break, because almost all these schools, everybody goes home if they're not already home for Thanksgiving break, and they don't come back until whenever we start school, if the school starts in person in January. So you're already in some sort of bubble. Now, remember, in basketball, you're in a bubble anyway. Everybody goes home for Christmas break. You stay. It doesn't matter. Now it's Thanksgiving break. So I don't know when college basketball starts, but my guess would be closer to December than it is Thanksgiving. I can only tell you that seems to be the chatter. Everybody is cautiously optimistic. There is an amount of pessimism. We'll see what happens after the election, if anything changes in terms of the course of action of the state and local governments. But it's really curious that we're operating on this assumption that games are going to be played in 1 month when, for example, Cal, as a major college conference program, won't be able to practice for 2 weeks. In addition to which, what will basketball look like? More practicing. So I do think that there'll be good offense and you will have a really good sense of what a coach is trying to accomplish. But without the games, like, when you go from practice to game, anybody who's played, you know, there's just a different level of intensity, the likelihood of soft tissue injuries. Now, we won't have the contact injuries of football, but you look at the litany of injuries in the National Football League, and you start to go, man, I don't know for a college athlete how many guys break down. It's a fascinating world to me. Last thing, I had Nate Bjorkgren on my radio show. You can download that podcast. Type in Doug Gottlieb Show, Nate Bjorkgren, and you can hear him, like, an amazing tale. And I think, remember the NFL 2 years ago, you had these copycats, anybody who knew Sean McVay got a job. And now you start to see where it's Frank Vogel and Eric Spoelstra, both guys who kind of came up through the ranks, Spoelstra video guy, Vogel video guy, climbed through the ranks. Obviously Vogel, this is his third stop, successful in Indiana, not so much in Orlando, wins a championship in his first year with the LA Lakers. Spoelstra has been to several NBA finals, obviously won championships in two of them with LeBron, and now has been to, I think, what, five NBA finals altogether. Both are really well respected. And then you look, whether it's, Silas gets the Rockets job and Nate Bjorkgren get the job, you say, okay, the Grinders are getting opportunities. I think the difference is, and this is a good thing, the difference is that so oftentimes playoff teams, when they hire a coach, would hire a guy with experience, much like the Philadelphia 76ers, they hired Doc Rivers, much like the LA Lakers, they hired Ty Lue. It doesn't mean those are bad hires, but those are more the traditional hires for a playoff team. You can't play in the playoffs unless you've won in the playoffs as a coach, right? how can you win a championship if you haven't won the championship or competed for a championship as a coach? I think the big change in the NBA is that you're given quality opportunities. The Pacers are a good team. Good team. They're not great. And Victor Oladipo didn't look healthy or right in Orlando, but they're a playoff team. You're giving Nate Bjorken his first team as a playoff team. That's a hell of an opportunity. Now, you're giving Silas a playoff team in Houston. That's a hell of an opportunity. Now, are there challenges that go with it? Absolutely. The Houston Rockets are wired for a style of basketball. I don't know if you can rewire. And I don't think you can get out of Russell Westbrook's contract. And I don't know if you can get James Harden to compete defensively. And you're working on a new GM and a new style. It's very, very difficult. But I do at least like the fact that young head coaches are not just getting the dregs of the league where it becomes confirmation bias. And college coaches used to have this all the time. College coaches could only get the bad jobs. And so they get to an NBA job and they, you know, do decently. And all of a sudden you'd run them out of town. Like, well, they didn't win much. Well, okay, nobody wins with those bottom jobs. That's why they're available to begin with. And then we turn to the developmental coach with the developmental team. Now we've gotten these kind of developmental coaches that have risen through the ranks that are unifiers. You know, they hire quality staffs. They work with the front office. They work together. They use analytics. And those are the guys now getting opportunities to coach with the big boys. And I think it's going to be fascinating to see exactly how they do. All right. My thanks to Phil Hickey for joining me. My thanks to you for downloading, subscribing, and rating, and listening to All Ball.